You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to host this monthly macro investing masterclass with two distinguished capital markets experts, namely Chris Watling, CEO of Longview Economics, and Edmund Shing, CIO at BNP Paribas Wealth Management. So welcome, gents.
Hello. Welcome. Hi. Yeah,
well, we've got lots to discuss today, not least, actually, the softer-than-expected US CPI data, which came out this afternoon. So maybe we can start there, Chris. What's your sort of latest sort of like thoughts on the direction of interest rates, the economy, and all things capital markets?
Hi, Paul. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think it was a good number. Number was better than expected. Month on month core is what I like to look at, sort of at the top, which was below expectations. And actually, if you look under the sort of surface, you look at some of the service sector stuff where there's been quite a lot of inflation. That's all easing. That's continued to ease. Particularly they have this weird thing called shelter in the States, which is quite a big part of their core inflation, much bigger than it is in the UK. If you strip that out. Because that's it's a bit of a statistical oddity. Strip it out, the underlying trend looks good. So I think the Fed, you know, they had the hawkish skip, but I'd say they're pretty close to being done, frankly. And it's interesting the way two-year bond yields have reacted this afternoon, falling sharply as they have been over the last week or two, suggesting the market's expecting less in terms of rate hikes, even a bit more in terms of cuts further out the curve as a result of this data point.
Okay, good. Well, if that was a bit of a sort of nothing burger then, Edmund, in terms of the inflation, what do you sort of expect for sort of the Q2 earnings season as we head in, sort of the start to kick off really this week, really, with JP Morgan and the banks?
Well, I have to say, I don't think it was a nothing burger. I would agree with you, it was better than expected. It was in line with what I was expecting, but then I've been a bit on the optimistic, on the glass half full side on the disinflation front. So that's good news. And as you said, as Chris pointed out, the bond markets reacted. Bond prices went up, yields went down, reflecting the fact that the Fed is pretty much done, right? Whether it does 25 basis, another 0.25% more or not, is neither here nor there. What we know, big picture, it's done. And most importantly, the ECB in Europe probably is not going to be too far from being done either, because history tells us that when the Fed stops raising, ECB generally is not too far behind on going on pause as well. Now, Q2 earnings is going to be very interesting, because the story thus far has been very much one of, in previous quarters, companies holding up profit margins very well. And that makes sense, because if you look at the analysis of what has been driving inflation, a lot of what has been driving inflation in the States, but particularly in Europe, has been companies being naughty and jacking up prices more than they needed to cover their costs, and of course, been boosting profit margins and therefore their earnings. Can that continue? My guess is no. The real question is, at what speed does this effect stabilize and reverse? I.e., can companies at least stabilize their pricing, stabilize the margins, and therefore see profitability hold in there? or will it decline? Will competition rear its ugly head for the companies, that is, which will be better for consumers, hurt inflation, kill inflation more, but obviously eat into potentially the profit margins of companies and therefore lead to earnings revisions downwards? That's going to be the big question. My guess is that we don't slam into reverse on profitability, that profitability and profit margins more or less stabilize, and that this maybe is more of a question for later quarters in the year.
Right. Okay. Now, Chris, in terms of sort of like that inflation, if we are sort of tracking down, will we sustainably stay at 2% if the labour market remains as strong as it is and we see wage growth at sort of like, you know, 5%, and in fact in the UK at 7%, because that seems to be the sort of the real conundrum facing the central banks. We can get it down as a one-off, but it's going to go back up again until we sort of nail the labour market and wage inflation.
Well, maybe. I mean, you know, that's sort of one of the views out there. That's kind of sort of, I suppose, what Bailey's talking about at the Bank of England, that there's a risk of a wage price spiral. I mean, the irony is, if you actually look at history, wage price spirals are incredibly rare. They're a bit of a myth. Everyone thinks they're kind of the thing to fear at the moment, but I don't think they are at all. I think the what we really need to fear is the fact that central banks have over-tightened in the West, whether you're looking in the UK or Europe or indeed the States. They've all tightened very aggressively because they fear the wage price spiral. But I mean, the IMF did a study recently, not too many months ago, looking at about 100 examples of surges in consumer price inflation accompanied by surges in wage inflation. And they found that the vast majority of them, no wage price spiral developed. In fact, they are in fact incredibly rare. I think there's one in the United States in the last 50 years, and there's not many in the UK either. So, you know, everyone talks about that. It kind of actually ultimately depends on the policy response in the recession, if we're right and one comes. Are they very aggressive and they turn on the taps hard again, and then you get a reacceleration of inflation, growth, and wages? Or do they actually try and sort of steady the ship? So I think the problem we've had with policy in the last 4 or 5 years really is it's been too aggressive in both ways. So we've had volatility induced into the economy because of it. And that's what we're seeing at the moment. We're seeing the after effects of too much stimulus in the pandemic. And now I think the next problem will be the after effects of too much tightening, sort of 12, 18 months down the road, or maybe sooner. So I think the bigger risk now is deflation. I know it sounds crazy when inflation's so high and wage inflation's so high, but the monetary metrics work with a lag. And as I've been saying to everyone, I'm not a monetarist, a Keynesian, an Austrian business side. I think they're all interested. And we are back in the age of monetarism for the first time in 4 decades. And actually, monetary policy is the way to go if you want to understand the economy from here. And sadly, that's not what central bankers are looking at. So monetarism has been out of fashion for 4 decades. But I think since the pandemic, it's really been exactly the place to look for clues as to where the economy is going. So I'm not so worried about the high wage inflation. I don't think it's an issue.
Mm. What about you, Edmund, in terms of timing, if wage inflation does get sort of, you know, to come out of the system? Are we looking at
But Paul, you've got to be careful here, because you guys are sitting in the UK. I'm sitting elsewhere. I'm sitting in Paris. The UK, I mean, I agree completely with Chris. I would say the UK is the only country which risks having a wage price spiral. And I hate to mention, I'm not going to mention the dreaded B word, but we all know why. Okay, we all know why.
I wouldn't agree with that. I think that's an easy comment to make. That's correct at all.
Okay, Chris, let me finish the thought then. I think it's a contributory factor, but I agree. I think there are other factors in there. I think the lack of productivity growth in the UK has been the real problem for a long time, as we know. I sort of put that down partly to the lack of education, to be honest with you. And also, to be honest with you, if I'm really critical about the UK education system, which is a great system, my 4 kids have all gone through it at the further education level. But I do think there are too many useless degrees out there, right? To be honest with you, you're getting these poor kids to pay a lot of money to be educated for 3 or 4 years in something which is of no practical use.
I think we're going a bit off script there, Ed.
No, but it's important for the productivity argument. I think that is one of the key reasons why productivity growth is not better in the UK. It's because we've got away from that. We've just got away from that. That's what education, you know, if you provide a career, you provide the tools for people to do a proper job and to do it well and to do it efficiently, guess what? Productivity growth goes back up.
I would have to say I don't think that's the main reason. I would agree with the education system's poor because you look at the OECD tables, we're near the bottom. The interesting thing about productivity is we may actually about to be surprised in the next 5 years positively to the upside. Because the reason I think productivity is poor, one of the reasons is two reasons. One's not going away. That's the fact the economy is financialized. But the second reason is we have a bunch of zombies and they're all dying. That is very good news. And I think, you know, ironically, Labour government are probably going to get into power and might turn up and find that the economy really starts to zing because the productivity comes back. So I don't know. Look, education is, of course, part of it, but I just don't think it's the main driver.
But I think you're right. I think the interesting addition to that, Chris, on the productivity side, which is, I think, very important for companies and profitability, and also for wage inflation, could be, I mean, I dread to just talk about artificial intelligence, because, I mean, yes, I've got a PhD in it. Yes, people are talking far too much about it. Let's just talk about technology overall, including artificial intelligence. I think that impact is going to be major on the labor market, on services, and therefore on productivity. And we all know productivity growth, for me, it's like evolution. It comes in waves. You get a burst of it when you get a shift, a structural change, let's say a technological change, or a change in business models, that lasts a while, and then nothing. And then it comes again when you get the next shift. And I think we're in that shift again. Companies are trying to adapt to this. And I think one thing we understand about technologies is the cycles are getting shorter. So, and companies are starting to understand that if they don't react to technological change, they'll become the next blockbuster. They will just disappear from view in a surprisingly short space of time. And that's making them invest. That's making them try to drive productivity. And I think you're right. We could be also surprised by productivity growth over the next 5 years. Because yes, the last few years have been terrible. As you see, after the global financial crisis, misallocation of capital due to ultra low interest rates, obviously, money was too cheap. People did stupid things with the money. And you know, we only have to talk about NFTs and so on to see evidence of that. But now, with that technology, with companies being paranoid about not wanting to be the next blockbuster, we could see that really come around. And it's not necessarily great for the labor market in the short term. In the longer term, maybe. In the short term, it does provide challenges to a whole range of professions in the service industries, particularly where there's routine jobs involved. Maybe those get really come under a lot of pressure.
I hope you're right. Can I come back on that, Paul? Have we got a minute or not?
Yeah, sure. No. Go for it.
I hope you're right, Edmund. I tell you what troubles me is it was exactly the same conversation about the internet in 1999, 2000. And we've all adopted the internet. It's changed all the way we work. We all know, you know, it's incredible, really. But it didn't drive higher productivity growth anywhere. In fact, probably trend growth was lower post the 1999, 2000 internet boom in stock markets in the 10 years that followed when it was adopted. So I don't know. I mean, I hope you're right. I mean, I'm just not convinced. I think actually we're back to Schumpeter. It's really about creative destruction. And that's the thing we haven't had because the economy has been soaked in money. And also the other part of financialization is not going away. We have far too much debt in these economies and that's not going to disappear. So we'll find out. I mean, AI is a great thing, but forecasting productivity is about as, it's basically impossible.
Okay. Yeah. And I mean, it's hard enough just to measure it. Let's be honest.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. I mean, basically, if we've got the zombies coming out, the zombie companies sort of like going bust, and we've got the sort of the generative AI or AI being put in with technology, then the wage inflation should get sorted in the matter of time. And
That's it. We panic about the service sector, but it's exactly the service sector where you could see the biggest impact in the next few years.
All right. Well, we've got a brilliant segue then into all things technology. Let's look for some sort of like, you know, winners and losers for the for the second half and next year. Now, obviously, we had all the poster child, the sort of Magnificent Seven tech stocks doing brilliantly in the first half, probably up by about a sort of average of 50% plus. So let's start off with the real sort of like the star performer, top of the NASDAQ, NVIDIA. Chris, now what's your sort of latest view? Because the bar must be just ultra high going into Q2 and going sort of like, you know, the view.
Well, I don't know. I think if you look at the price action, it looks like it's either consolidating or it's topping out. I mean, that much is clear. You're quite right. It was up over 100% in the first half of the year. extraordinary stock market performance and everyone chased it. I thought, you know, I mean, who knows? It's very difficult to take a view on these things. I thought it was interesting, and I've spoken to a lot of fund managers who avoided it or had owned it and don't own it anymore and find the valuation very hard to justify. I think what's interesting about the sort of the tech stocks, the Magnificent Seven, the semi stocks, all these kind of stocks, is really, if you look at global tech relative to the global stock market, it is it's the most expensive it's been on a valuation basis since really the sort of height of the TMT bubble. So from here, you've either got to argue these stocks need to get more expensive and therefore go into bubble territory, or they've got to tread water and catch up with their valuations or even sell off. And I suspect it'll be the latter. I've never known anyone correctly forecast a bubble, which is essentially what you have to do to keep buying these stocks. You've got to forecast and believe that they should go into a bubble phase. And look, I mean, half the market seems to think that's the case.
Yeah.
So it's almost definitely not going to happen. It's too obvious. I mean, markets don't do obvious things, and they don't do what everyone's talking about. And everyone has been talking about that, certainly up until the last couple of weeks. So I think it's been a great run, sure. You know, you may get lucky on the stock, but I think it's outgrown. It's outgrown what a sensible valuation it should be on.
Yeah,
it should.
Yeah, what do you reckon, Ed, when you turn the tech sector? Because obviously you've got really good insight into sort of like you know, generative AI or AI. We've got Google would be cannibalized by sort of, you know, generative AI. And likewise with things like Tesla, with sort of like the rock star Elon Musk out there. I mean, everything's just gone up and up and up. Are they priced to perfection now?
I mean, I think that there is a danger. There is a danger, Paul, that with all of this disruptive technology, that actually there may be no winners. People don't think about that. The winner, let's take the internet. I mean, as Chris mentioned before, the internet was a big, big thing in the 2000s. Who was the winner ultimately? The winner ultimately is probably the consumer, right?
Google not many did companies. Pretty well. Google Sorry? Did pretty well.
Yeah, yeah.
No, and Amazon.
In the end, but not from 2000.
Not in 2000, though, were they? I don't think they were around in 2000.
They weren't listed. They weren't. And by the way, Amazon, yes, but Amazon lost 95% from the peak first. Mm. And if you can tell me any shareholder, apart from Jeff Bezos, the founder, who held on all the way down and then all the way back up again, I'll tip my hat to them, but there won't be very many. I think you can count them probably in two hands. I mean, really, nobody survives that sort of volatility without you know, and doesn't sell at some point. So I think it's difficult, but I would argue that the winner may be the company, other consumers. Maybe the best way to play this trend going forwards is to think about which sectors will benefit from the implementation of AI to improve growth, productivity, demand. For instance, like the healthcare industry, I think we are at this tip of a medicine 3.0 paradigm, as Peter Attia, the longevity specialist, talks about, where we don't just think about you get sick, you go to see the doctor, you get some sort of drug treatment, or if it's really bad, you get surgery to fix the problem. The idea being, you don't want to see the doctor, you don't want to have the symptoms, so maybe let's do a bit of prevention, use diagnostics, do simple things like take vitamin D, for instance, or get proper sleep and exercise. You know, I know it sounds really basic, but do the simple things in terms of prevention so that you don't get the symptoms, you never need the drugs. Mm. And that's the medicine 3.0, like thinking about lifestyle a bit more, thinking about the risk factors and thinking about how to avoid getting the symptoms in the first place. And with that sort of approach, which I think technology and AI in particular can definitely help with, particularly in the diagnostic side of things, and, you know, things like wearables, for instance. So you have monitors telling you your blood pressure and telling you your blood sugar levels. This all exists. This is all technology that exists today, but it's not widespread enough. And I think healthcare could be one of the sectors that really benefits over the next few years from the boom in technology, the shift in mindset, and the sort of shift in wellness that we've seen since COVID. I think if that really takes hold, then healthcare could be a sector, but not just the drug makers, but also everything to do with diagnostics. That could be a very interesting place to be.
What about GSK? And obviously it's been a bit of a laggard, to say the least. It's trading at about 8x PE.
Yeah, the problem is always the same. It's about, is it X? Yeah, I mean, everyone assumes it's X growth, right? Now, obviously you've had the spin-off, you've had the consumer Amhalian separating from the actual sort of drug businesses, the pharmaceutical business, which is still Glaxo. The question is, can they refine sustain that growth? Can they regenerate the growth? The answer at 8x P seems to be no. It's heavily, clearly valued as X growth. But the good news is expectations are therefore correspondingly very low. Mm. Right? 8x, you're pricing basically value destruction, like a bank or something. Yeah. You're saying these guys are going to destroy value. They're not going to add any value. And that's why it's priced 8x. So in a sense, you could argue with a good following win for the sector. And if they're not completely incompetent at the management level in terms of implementation and execution, it might be an interesting place to be, frankly. And you get a decent yield while you're waiting anyway.
Mm. Chris, have you got any sort of like, you know, add-on to that, sort of the technology players, or how you'd want to sort of like, you know, play this, or, you know, how you see it? Or
well, ironically, I think you know, I have this sort of theory that markets have fashions and sector leadership changes every 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. And I think we've had tech leadership for too long now. So I kind of think it's done. So yeah, I'm sure there are lots of other ways to play it. Yeah. But I, you know, that's not the sort of stuff we dig into.
What about the oil sector? What about the sort of the big integrated oils? Because obviously they've done a bad first half as well. All things sort of materials and commodities and even, you know, the black stuff. Everybody was hoping that China was going to be reopening, and what you've really got now is OPEC sort of cutting production to try and support the price.
Go on, Chris. I was going to say, I think the oil price it's obviously been in a bear market for 12 plus months now. And the market is coming into balance. So, in fact, if you look at Brent, it's found quite a bit of support around the $70 level several times. I'm not entirely convinced we're quite done yet with oil to the downside, but we've been bearish for 12 months. I always thought when everyone talked about $200 oil, that was just classic market narrative near a top. Everyone gets carried away to the upside. And it looks now to us like, in terms of fundamentals, the market's much closer to being in balance. So you mentioned OPEC cutting supply. They've done a few cuts now. If we get a recession that we think we will, then demand obviously comes off a bit. But even accounting for all that and the slightly softer Chinese reopening that people expect, it looks like the fundamentals are aligning. And I think we're pretty close. I just wouldn't want to buy oil ahead of a likely recession. I think you buy it into the recession when you get a bit of a sell-off into that. Positioning-wise, people are still a bit too long and sentiment's still a bit too bullish, and you want that to be washed out of the market. And once you get that, then the oil majors will find a trough and the oil price will find a trough, and I think they'll be very attractive. The long-term CapEx story in oil hasn't changed. We talked about it before. I think the lack of it, the lack of CapEx, the lack of new discoveries. I think it was the IEA the other day or one of them talking about the amount of oil that's needed in 10, 15 years' time. And it's a ton more than we've got at the moment. So there's no doubt, stop oil in the UK are not doing a great job. Let's put it that way. People are consuming a lot of oil and they're going to be consuming a lot more. If I was them, I'd go to China and try doing a bit of just stop oil there. Although I don't think they'd like the reception they'd get. But they're consumers of oil in a much bigger way than we are. And actually, if you look at the last 10, 15 years, the growth in oil demand is all in emerging markets, not in the West at all. I think the Western aggregate is completely flat on 10 years in terms of oil demand. So I think the oil majors are getting interesting. Perhaps not quite there yet. Edwin know the detail of the stocks better than I do, but yeah. They've got good dividends, I believe.
Just on the timing, I mean, I think you made a really, really good point because, yeah, the PEs currently look very low, sort of 6 to 7x, et cetera. But actually what you're saying is if we do go to a slight downturn towards a mild recession or whatever, that E is falling, and therefore the PE ratio is artificially sort of like misrepresented at too high, and therefore you're really potentially catching a falling knife here for the short term.
Well, there's that, and there's really the idea that you buy oil stocks when the oil price troughs. I mean, they're basically, it's like all commodity stocks. They're essentially driven entirely, or 90% of what drives them is really where the commodity price goes. Yeah. So, you know, that's their correlation. So if you get the oil price right, you get the trough there right, you'll get the entry point right. But if you're a 3 to 5 year investor, average in over the next 6 to 9 months. I mean, yeah. Don't try and be clever.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Edmund, so, Edmund, what about your thoughts on the commodity sector? So we've got in the, you've obviously got Rio, we've got BMP, we've got Glencore and Anglo, etc. Some of them slightly different. We've got iron ore and coal with Glencore. We've got iron ore with BMP and with and copper with Rio, and some of the precious metals with Anglo. What's your sort of your preferred plays here at all? Because they all trade at pretty low valuations.
They are, Paul. I mean, my focus is on the metals I think were the best demand and supply outlooks for the next few years. So the sort of metals I'm thinking about are nickel, tin, copper, maybe lithium, but certainly nickel, tin and copper, because you use them in all sorts of things. For instance, whether we talk about renewable energy and solar panels, you need tin and you need copper, a lot of it. If you're thinking about this whole boom in renewables and the infrastructure, the grid infrastructure that needs to be upgraded to be able to accept all the solar panels and wind turbines, again, copper wiring, again, it's going to be massive. So I'm looking at the producers of copper, so copper miners. So yeah, you've mentioned some of them, but those are what you've mentioned are really global. They are global miners and very, very diverse in terms of the types of materials that they mine, not just copper and but as iron ore, coal. I'm still doing a lot of coal in many places, and so in many ways, it sometimes might be better to look for something a bit specialised. In copper. The problem is there aren't very many. There's like Atalaya, there is Antofagasta, in copper. In nickel, even less, actually. It's very difficult to find specialized nickel miners. In tin, even harder, you end up going to places like Canada for Alphamin Resources. I mean, I know there's Cornish tin in the UK, but they don't produce anything yet, so I'm waiting. When they produce, then I'll talk about them, But these are the sorts of areas I'm looking at. And that tells me that at the current time, as Chris said, if you've got a recession coming in front of you, why are you buying these diversified mines? Because they do a bit of everything. A lot of everything will be driven much more by global demand and therefore the economy than anything else. And you're not necessarily at the sweet spot. You either want to buy in the teeth of recession or you want to buy in boom times, but we're not at either at the moment just yet.
Chris, just on that sort of recession call, how deep will this be and when will it be, do you reckon?
What are two brilliant questions, Paul? That's what everyone asks. I mean, how deep will it be? I mean, personally, I think it actually will be, economically speaking, quite a mild recession, because this isn't like the GFC. This isn't about massive amounts of economic excess. This is about tight money and actually financial market excess. So things like commercial real estate prices that are under pressure and causing the banks to tighten up. So liquidity tightens up into the economy. So I don't think it'll be a particularly deep recession. And generally the sort of non-deep ones last sort of three quarters or so, maybe a tiny bit longer. And when might it come? You know, I think the best way to judge this is it's really difficult, because the sort of old rule of thumb was 12 to 24 months after the inversion of the yield curve, generally recessions start. And we're sort of 12, 15 months after the inversion. But I think the best way to think about it is why have we held on as long as we have? And it's kind of all that cash that everyone's had. So it's running out. So if you work out when all that extra pandemic savings runs out, which we think is probably end of Q3, Q4, or when it runs out for most of the income groups. I mean, the upper income, it doesn't really matter ever. So, but you can see, I mean, you look at the lower income, you look at the profit warnings from Dollar General, the comments from the sort of the retailers like Walmart, clearly people are feeling it. So it's worth, you know, the cash is running out up the income scale, down the lower, moving into the second quartile, and we'll get into the third, according to our calculations, as we get towards the end of this year. And I think that's the time you're going to get the recession basically begin.
Okay, so Edmund, here's another sort of like great question, I hope, anyway. If the stock market views that there's going to be a recession or potential recession back end of this year, early next year, as Chris suggests, et cetera, but we bring it, bring the stock market sort of, you know, forecasting 6 to 9 months before, we're looking for a bit of a sort of like a soft patch, aren't we, presumably? And the stock market, given it, the S&P, I know it's a magnificent seven, but it's on a sort of 19 times PE.
Well, yeah, but we're getting a soft patch for certain sectors. I think that's the point. So you've mentioned commodities. Well, we've seen, again, which are pretty economically sensitive on a global basis. Well, they are going through a soft patch. I mean, as I say, mining and energy have had a poor run after a very good run last year. They've had a very poor run this year in relative terms. So there are economically sensitive sectors that have performed poorly already. The fly in the ointment, as we mentioned before, is the earnings outlook, the earnings revisions. And numbers have been much stronger than we expected. Bizarrely, actually in Europe, even more than in the US. And again, it's going to come back to at what point do consumers really vote with their feet and force companies to cut prices, force profitability down, and then start a spiral where companies then start to cut their costs and potentially also lay off people. Because, you know, again, that's the real spiral we're looking for. Mm. And if you were to look at temporary service employment in the US, which is typically a good leading indicator for where employment as a whole is going in the US, that has weakened to the point where you would expect employment as a whole to weaken again. And if you look at non-farm payrolls in the US as in trend terms, it is trending lower. It's still above the what I would call the break-even of about 100. I don't know the number exactly. Chris will tell us. But usually it's between 125 to 150,000 a month is what I remember being the break-even where you need to stabilize the employment rate. We're still above that, but not much above it, actually. We're, you know, the last number was 209,000. There were big revisions down in previous data. So actually, and if you look at the trend of non-farm payrolls, it's the line is clearly slowing. It is slowing. So, and the number of vacancies are drying up. So there is an effect in the US labor market. It's just not so much in the unemployment rate, but in other bits of employment, as it were. Europe's the same. We are seeing companies becoming markedly more cautious about employment looking forwards and maybe thinking, okay, we might try to hang on to the workers we've got, but we certainly don't want to hire any more. And if they leave, maybe we won't rush to replace them either. Mm. That's sort of where we are at the moment.
Okay, so effectively the market is looking through and looking past a mild recession anyway, in totality, because it sees better times ahead, I'm guessing, would be.
Well, this is it. If consumption doesn't really take a big hit because wage growth is still there, because unemployment doesn't really go up, then we say the European, the UK, the US economies, whatever it is, 2/3 to 70% services and consumption, why should there be a deep recession? And maybe we can look, as you said, maybe we can look through that. That seems to be what the markets are doing at the moment.
Okay.
Unlikely. We've had 15 recessions in the US since since pre-World War II, all of them being associated with bear markets, except for the one in 1945, which was, I think the problem here is earnings. And the problem is, as you sort of alluded to, is we've had record high margins. Hmm. So if you get volumes contracting and prices coming off,
of course,
it's actually a real challenge for company earnings. That's what, you know, I think what the markets do, the debate in the market now is it's the participation's broadened in the last month. June was a very strong month. It wasn't just the Magnificent Seven, it was the cyclicals as well. Hmm. So the debate in the market is, are we genuinely starting a cyclical rally that might last for a while? In which case, my view on recession is probably wrong. Or is this just, you know, oversold cyclical sectors bouncing and the whole market's going to roll over as we get into the summer? And I think, you know, I do agree with Eben. The point, you know, on the labor market is correct. It's clearly slowing in the States at the margins. And that is the last piece of the recession puzzle. So if that continues, then I suspect it is rolling over. So I think it's a very difficult second half. The first half surprised us all because everyone was bearish. Now everyone's bullish. And I think the second half might surprise us all as well.
Okay.
Generally how markets work.
Okay. So on that assumption then, Chris, what about the health of the consumer? Because two sort of like consumer stocks, Carnival Cruises and Royal Caribbean, they're number one and number two in the world for cruise liners. They've absolutely knocked the ball out of the park in the first half. In fact, they're both in the NASDAQ top five performers in the first 6 months, up over 100%, which is just crazy. And likewise, sort of like, you know, Unilever and Nestle and people like that have been pretty stable as well. What's your sort of view on the consumer and whether that is sustainable given your sort of macro call?
Well, I mean, it shouldn't be sustainable. No, I mean that shouldn't be carrying on. I mean, part of that is the sort of post-pandemic thing. I mean, and look, I don't really know the stocks in detail, but I suspect they're pretty beaten up coming into it. So, you know, I mean, if a stock's down 90% and it doubles, it's still down 80%. So you've got to be careful with stats like that. What I would say is what's fascinating to me is if you look at all the sectors of the world stock market, one of the cheapest sectors a clear standout, and also one of the most oversold sectors is consumer staples, which is a defensive sector. And actually, the stock market almost never goes up when defensive sectors outperform. And if they're very cheap and they're oversold, and you pair it with another sector that's very expensive and very overbought, like IT, you tend to find a very good rotation within the market. And as I said, if the market rotates into defensives and consumer staples, that means it's going down. Basically, that's when staples outperform. So, Carnival Cruise. Well, I mean, good luck to them. I mean, I don't know. I mean,
boats anyway for the time.
That's great. They probably got less boats than they had 2 years ago. But I don't know. But yeah,
it feels a bit toppy, probably. But anyway, let's move on now to Edmund. In terms of the sort of the banking sector, obviously, you know, that's taken a bit of a breath this first half as well. And I know you've talked about sort of like the boring banks before, the likes of, Lloyds, et cetera, and you've mentioned AXA. What about also the sort of special situation out in UBS with having bought sort of like, you know, Credit Suisse?
Yeah, UBS is going to be a strange one because it's going to be difficult to decrypt for a while to understand what's going on. Obviously, they have announced that they're going to be making up to 60% of Credit Suisse employees are going to be let go.
Yeah.
So that's going to be A, expensive, and B, potentially cause a lot of turmoil in the underlying businesses. When you're letting that many people go, you know, it's got to cause disruption, at least in the short term. So, it's not something I would want to get too excited about here because you'd want to see the dust settle and all of that to figure out what on earth is going on.
What about Barclays, for instance? Because I've had so many investor questions in terms of head scratchers. Why is it trading at a sort of 60% discount to, you know, net assets?
The problem with Barclays, in my view, is that they still suffer from the after, and I did work there for a while. They still suffer to some extent from their investment banking exposure. They still have investment banking exposure. They tried to be very big under the stewardship of Bob Diamond back in the day. And the problem is, it's not where people want to be. You know, if you want to be in investment banking, you want to be buying Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, you know, the premier US bulge bracket banks. Barclays continue to try to compete with these guys, but they're just not really in the same league. So the suspicion has to be that their profitability will never get anywhere close, and therefore that there is a lot of potential value destruction going on by hanging on to it. You know, the jewel in the crown for something like Barclays has actually always been credit cards, Barclaycard, not just the card issuer, but the card processing division, as in processing all the transactions, because I think they, back in the day, used to process, they probably still process something like 25% of all credit and debit card transactions in the UK. And that's really been the jewel in the crown. And yeah, if that business were quoted by itself and no investment banking attached with it, I'm sure it would attract a much higher valuation. But the investment bank, I think, continues to drag it down.
Right. What about Lloyds in terms of, because it's obviously all the UK banks came through with a sort of like apparently a clean bill of health from the Treasury
but we've got to come back to Chris's point about recession, and in particular the UK is a special case because again the UK is in this point where the risk is that the Bank of England will have to tighten even more than other central banks because inflation seems to be even stickier in the UK, at least for now. And of course, you know, you're looking at people who are basically sitting on a two-year fixed mortgage, and when it comes up for renewal, you're talking from an average rate going from somewhere 2.5% as it was 2 years ago to 6.6% as it would be today. That is an enormous jump. I mean, I can't figure it out in my head what that means for the average monthly mortgage repayment, but it's got to be a huge jump. And that's going to be very difficult for people to afford. And then you have to therefore suggest that the level of bad debts that UK retail banks have is going to rise.
Right.
Yeah, I actually think the banks are going to fly in a few months' time. We get into the recession.
Exactly.
You're quite right. The rates are too high. People are going to be squeezed. So it means the Bank of England, I don't think UK inflation is that sticky. It just appears sticky. It'll dissipate pretty fast like it is in the States eventually. And then the Bank of England will start cutting. And banks like Lloyds have got tons of capital they want to put to work. There's no houses available for sale. The transactions have dried up. As soon as you start cutting, this sector is going to fly, and it's going to lead the market for the next 3 to 5 years. So I think they're great stocks to buy on weakness or buy again, average in over the next 6-9 months.
I would agree with Chris. And what I would add is just watch the 2-year bond yield, the 2-year gilt yield. Because clearly, 2-year fixed rates are going to be fixed off the 2-year bond yield. Once the 2-year bond yield peaks and starts to go down, hallelujah, that means that you know, banks will fall over themselves to offer more attractive 2-year fixed rate mortgages. And as Chris says, that will reignite activity in the housing market from pretty much standstill. House builders will probably get to fly as well, because people will suddenly say, oh, they're not going to go bust. Of course, they're not going to go bust. The only question is, as Chris points out, what is the correct entry timing for the entry point? And that is probably when people are really panicking about the outlook for the housing market and for mortgages, which is pretty much now or soon.
The number of households with a mortgage in the UK is the lowest it's ever been.
It's true.
As a share of the total.
The southeast.
Yeah.
Most people own their houses outright. So what's the impact? Bugger all. It's only in the southeast. It's a big impact.
It is. It's bugger all. But also, they've actually doing very well on their savings as well.
That's true. That's true.
So it kind of works both ways.
Yeah.
So if the 2-year bond yield or gilt yield is the sort of the weather vane of you're timing it, sort of getting into the banks. I mean, at the moment, we've got sort of Andrew Bailey sort of like indicating that he's going to increase by half 50 basis points.
Yeah, but Paul, he's got to do that. That's his job. He's got to scare people. Yeah.
So the market's pricing it in.
Of course they are now, but what Andrew Bailey wants to do is talk the talk, so he doesn't have to walk the complete walk in the end. Yeah. Right? If he can scare the market, right, and get the reaction behavior that he wants to calm it down, then he maybe doesn't have to jack interest rates up all the way. And then Chris will be right even sooner, because then that gives Bailey more leeway with the change in behavior that he wants to then maybe at least stabilize rates at a lower level than the market thinks, and then eventually to cut them.
Do you agree with that, Chris?
What was it? Well, Carney, we used to call the unreliable boyfriend, didn't we? I just wonder what we should be calling Bailey. I mean,
words
I don't mean to speak out of turn. I don't mean to speak out of turn.
If it's a bit of a charade, then we'll accept that, because it certainly could be, no doubt about it. Now, Chris, if banks are obviously quite cyclical and it's going to rip, what about the industrials? Because in the UK, I mean, they've done pretty poorly. Well, things like got special situations, but sort of that sort of sector, it's quite cyclical, obviously.
Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, there's so many parts of the industrial cycle, aren't there? I suppose you've got to be slightly careful. But again, I'd rather move into the defensive areas of the market rather than the cyclical area of the market here, for all the reasons we talked about. You've got to get into the recession before you start thinking about those stocks. And I think global industrials are quite expensive, actually, as a sector, if I remember correctly. I'm not entirely sure about the UK standalone.
Yeah, the US is very expensive.
Yeah, so I think you've got to be slightly careful. Also, if you look at someone like China, which benefits from a lot of the global industrial cycle, but also drives a lot of it with its housing market. I mean, its housing market is falling apart, and that is something I think we need to be careful on. So I think you've got to be this defense cycle that's good. I mean, everyone's spending money on defense stocks and defense weaponry and so on because of what's going on in Ukraine. So that's going through its own cycle. There's housing cycles which are very poor around the world, where there's real challenges. So there's a different part of the industrial cycle there. And then you've got the auto cycle, where no one could buy a car a few years ago. And so actually car sales are doing better than they might otherwise do. So industrials, to lump them into one group is quite a dangerous thing at this point. But in general, I wouldn't be chasing them here. I would be waiting to get into the recession. Then I would buy them.
Okay. Now, Edmund, just find in one sector, in insurers, because obviously it was an area a few months ago you quite liked, with likes of sort of AXA, etc. What's your sort of latest on that area? Because we were a bit scared at the time because of the banking crisis out in the States, but actually it seems to have been pretty much sort of done and dusted. Yeah.
I think it is pretty much. I don't think that's going to be a big impact for the insurers. I think the issue is, I mean, if you look at AXA as an example, there has been some short-term worries about all that's gone in France. I mean, there have been riots. Riots are not good for insurers because, damage. There's a lot of damage, a lot of repairing needed. The repair bill's big. Who picks up the tab? Well, the insurers pick up a lot of the tab. So that's a, but that's a specific issue. I would say it, for me, if I'm going to pick one thing I would look at right now, it would be life insurance and companies like Legal & General in particular, because there's one area of the market which is very interesting, which is that because bond yields have gone up so much, particularly in the UK, defined benefit pension funds are going to are starting to run to lock in these yields by basically handing over their entire defined benefit pension fund to specialized companies like Legal & General, who can just take all of this fund and the problem off their hands, say, don't worry, you pay us, we buy that, we basically take the fund off your hands, and then you have nothing more to worry about. We will worry about that from here on out. And companies love that because, of course, it then takes the risk off their books, and they don't want pension fund risk. And I think because of where bond yields are now, this is going to happen hand over fist for all the defined benefit funds that have not done it yet. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, companies like Legal & General should do pretty well out of that, that increase in business that we're going to see.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, actually, transfer of bulk
and
annuities.
And just bulk annuities and annuities in general, individual annuities. Mm-hmm. You know, people have been scared away with all the pension freedoms from buying annuities. Well, you know what? With the current bond yields where they are, it's pretty attractive to buy an annuity now, and much more attractive than it was a few years ago. So actually, they might make even individual annuities can make a bit of a comeback.
Yeah. Now, Chris, I'm going to ask you a bit of a cheeky question right at the end. The sterling, if we're nearly at 130 now against the dollar, is this sustainable? Because, it just seems amazing bounce back, obviously, in only 6 or 9 months from the trust low of $1 to the pound.
Well, that's what currencies do, isn't it? They're, you know, everyone was short at a buck, the one level, and now actually everyone's long. I mean, the whole market's completely changed from being uber bearish to uber bullish. Is it sustainable? It depends on your time frame. I think sterling's going to do really well over the next 3 to 5 years because basically, if you really stand back from it, no one's invested in the UK. Everyone left the UK post-Brexit. Everyone assumes the economy's a disaster. Trustonomics has ruined our reputation internationally. And actually, as I said, the zombies are dying and it's going to be fantastic for growth. And once we get through this sort of recession and we start cutting rates, housing is going to fly. Consumers are going to fly, the economy is going to seem good, and the money is going to flood back. So I would say I wouldn't buy the pound today because I think it's a little bit overcooked short term. But I think it's going to be a great currency on a 3 to 5 year view. And I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be fantastic.
That's a brilliant positive note to finish. And maybe just to sort of counter that one, Edmund, is there anything to look for, anything to watch out for over the next month that you'll be? Obviously, we've got the Fed at the end of the end, but that's well signaled. They're going to go up by sort of a quarter of a basis point in on the 26th of July. Mm. Not really.
It's difficult because we're entering that sort of quiet period in the summer, and you know volatility can spike because of course volumes are low. But is there any one event I'm worried about? Not particularly. Although I would say the one thing we need to keep our eyes on is the incredibly poor momentum we've seen in the European economy over the last 2 months. At some point, either that keeps on getting worse, I hope not, or it bottoms and rebounds. And I think it could bottom and rebound. And I think allied to that, we should look at the manufacturing PMIs in the US, like the ISM or indeed even the one published by S&P Global. Because again, that has been weak. But it's showing signs of about to rebound, particularly if you look at new goods versus the inventory components. They usually are a good advanced leading indicator of the overall ISM, and they're pointing up already. Mm. So if you get that rebound, we might get, I don't know how long it lasts, but it actually might look like better news in the short term, both on the European front, because it's been so bad, but it also on the US side in manufacturing, because yes, services has held up in the US, manufacturing's been poor, but there are some hints that it could be, at least in the short term, better in the US.
Mm. Anything you're watching at all, Chris, for the next month or so?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say I agree with all those things mentioned. I've watched jobless claims like a hawk. I wouldn't normally say watch a weekly data point, but actually it's a very good insight into how the labour market's doing on a week-by-week basis. And you look at the smooth trend, it's kind of fascinating. And actually, of course, US earnings season begin on Friday with the big banks. Go on for the next few weeks. That's going to be interesting. Mm. And yeah, as Edmund says, French service sector PMI falling apart. What's going on there? And you know, is the US service sector going to lift the US manufacturing sector, or is it going to be the other way around? And jobless claims will give you some insights into that. So all of that, to be honest, the amount of stuff we watch is big, but those things in particular, I think, are fascinating.
All right, brilliant. Well, thanks very much again for your insights and comments. Absolutely fabulous. And look forward in touching base in August. Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.